everyone. Welcome to Garden Fork Radio. I'm your host, Eric Rothschild. Today, a special guest. I say special guest every time, but if you're a Garden Fork Radio, you're special to me. But a while back, a publisher sent me a book called Yes, You Can, and Freeze and Dry It Too by Daniel Gasteiger. And I read it, and I was like, wow, I really like this book. It's got a lot of great information on it. And then I read in the little bio, and I look at this guy's picture, and I'm like, I know this guy. And then it gives his Twitter handle, his Twitter name, and I'm like, oh, it's City Slipper. But I never knew your name was Daniel Gasteiger. So...
Well, I think when you meet people in person who you've met on Twitter, you tend to have that stumbling block of, wait, who are you? Wait, tell me your handle. And then you end up calling people by their handle instead of their real name. So
yeah,
I'm used to it.
Anyway, it's great to have you on. Hello.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So what I like about your book is it's called The Modern Step-by-Step Guide to Preserving Food. First of all, it's chock full of pictures, and I'm big on pictures. And it's not real dense with paragraphs. It has step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Step 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And that's perfect for me, and I think it's perfect for a lot of people that might have an apprehension about this. What got you started doing canning and freezing, pickling, that kind of thing?
Well, that's almost it's going to age me to admit it, but my mom just had that discipline that she was, it seems to me, all summer tomatoes, peaches especially, were going into jars, and she made a lot of jelly too. So I think I made my first jam actually. I remember it was plum jam in her kitchen. I was probably 7 or 8 years old.
Nice.
And I remember very well that I burned it. And that's where I first learned if you burn it, add a little.
Sorry,
I had something weird for lunch.
No, that's one of my Labradors.
And hence your love for being able to edit.
Hold on,
does that one go on too?
All right, we'll be back in a minute. If you want to leave us a comment or a question or just kind of talk to us, you can leave us a message at our Garden Fork Radio voicemail, 860-740-6938. That's 860-740-6938. So we were talking about that you burn the plum jam, but and then you remember it. It kind of burns, that kind of moment burns into your brain. And I think that kind of, it's interesting how that, I don't know how the neurons work and all that, but you can recall that. And it's was kind of a seminal event for you.
Well, I learned then, my mom, of course, to the rescue said, oh, we have to add some almond extract. And I didn't know why. And I don't know what it would have been like if we hadn't, but having added the almond extract, I couldn't really taste a burn flavor in the finished jam.
Wow.
You don't scrape the bottom of the pot anymore once it burns, cause you don't want to get that stuff into it. But so I kind of learned then, and I've heard from other people over the years. Yeah. If you want to kind of mask or eliminate a burned flavor in your jams and jellies, you can throw in some almond extract. So it was kind of my first tip about canning back when I was quite young. And those were the days, of course, when you didn't actually can the stuff. You filled the jar and you poured melted paraffin on top.
I remember that, yeah.
And, the jam would ooze up around the edges, or the paraffin would crack, and you'd get little puddles of syrup that would mold. And your mom would take them out of the cabinet and say, oh, look, it molded, and flip the paraffin out, scrape off the mold, and put it in your sandwich. Not the mold, but the stuff without mold.
Yeah, it's still perfectly good.
Well, apparently the USDA no longer thinks so.
Oh, wow.
And in fact, I've spoken to someone from the USDA who said, I wish they'd stop putting that stuff out on the shelves with the other canning supplies, because apparently the molds that grow can actually cause some kind of illnesses. I'm not sure what. Maybe they're parsonages or something. So
I haven't seen it in a long time, except for one older friend of ours that gave us some jam, and it had the, instead of a, everyone that's listening, instead of a canning jar with a metal lid, you know, the, with the band, is they poured a paraffin wax across the top to seal it. So that's interesting.
And I wouldn't be afraid of that, but I understand, you know, I tried to emphasize, look, the USDA tests this stuff and they give you procedures that are pretty much guaranteed not to kill you.
Yeah.
So if they're telling you don't use paraffin anymore, chances are it's a bad idea to use paraffin.
Note to self.
Yeah.
So you've taken this basically childhood memory and kind of gone 1,000% farther with it, with your book. Because in addition to just talking about canning, you hit on, first of all, high acid canning, which is like tomatoes and things, which is daunts me. And then you go on to drying as well. Pickling, I do some pickling. But what's your favorite?
I'm not sure I have a favorite.
Okay.
One of my fondest memories from preserving stuff with my family was maple sugaring, which I don't talk about in the book other than to acknowledge I stole the term sugaring from making maple syrup. But, yep. You know, we would spend much time in February up in the woods when there was maybe snow on the ground, drawing sap out of trees and cooking it down. And that's such a great memory for me. I would spread a blanket on the ground in front of the fire and nap while the syrup or sap cooked down. And, there were horses involved and stuff. So a very, very romantic kind of experience. But yeah. I don't do that anymore. So, you know, it's a shame that might be my favorite activity. So, but I really do. Any of the preserving I do, I find very meditative. That, you know, if you're making jam or jelly, you're standing there stirring a pot for 20 or 30 minutes straight. When you're preparing produce to put in jars or to put on your dehydrator, you might spend hours cutting it up, washing it, peeling it, whatever. So all that is very, I think, meditative. It just lets my mind wander and maybe even go quiet. So, but I like it all. I'll give you the real cop out answer. I like eating it.
Yeah. Cool. So why don't we step through each one of these and maybe we can give the listeners a tip on each one. Let's start with canning, which is actually really putting them into what I call mason jars. What is there a common mistake or a little hint that you can give people?
Let me throw a tidbit at you. I learned from friends in Europe on Twitter that they call it jarring. And when I spoke of canning in my Twitter feed, they were like, what's that? You use cans? And so anyway, are there common mistakes people make? One that I see repeated a lot that I find really scary, and I've even seen blog posts where people have photos of their canning operation, and they have jars sitting in pots of water, and the shoulders and lids of the jars are sticking out of the water. And these things are cooking away, and they think they're canning. I mean, they are creating a vacuum seal in the jar.
Right.
But the heat in that top portion of the jar from the shoulders up to the rim doesn't develop to the boiling point of water. And they're just not getting a guaranteed sterilization there. I just find that really scary because, you know, if you don't kill everything in the jar, it can grow once you put it on the shelf. And then when you open the jar, if you're lucky, you'll notice before you eat it. So that's, to me, that would be probably the biggest mistake you can make. You know, the directions are clear. It's got to be underwater and, you know, an inch of water above the top of the jar at least.
This is after we've put the rhubarb or peaches or whatever in the jar. We've put the lid on it with the band and then we've put it in the boiling water to do what they call the processing time, like process for 10 minutes.
Exactly.
The boiling water should be at least an inch or two over the biggest jar, the tallest jar you've got in that thing.
Exactly. And this is for the boiling water bath method of canning, which you use for the high acid foods, fruits and tomatoes with a little additional acid. For pressure canning, the rules are completely different. But
yeah, I have yet to tackle the pressure canning. It seems more daunting to me. Is it?
I don't think so at all. Really, the procedures for preparing food are the same. And for putting them in the jars are the same. Everything you do is the same up until you put the stuff in a canning pot and put it on the stove.
Right.
And then even that, the times are similar because with the pressure canner, you have a much shorter time to cook it.
Because it is under pressure.
Because it's under pressure. But there's a ramp up time. It takes about 10 minutes to get to where you actually start pressurizing, where you're just boiling the water with the jars in it. And then there's a cool down time that you can't just take it off the stove and open the canner, or you'll probably, you know, end up in the hospital. So you have to take it off the stove and let it cool down.
Depressurize, basically.
But yeah, exactly. Whereas with the boiling water bath canner, you know, it takes a while to get the water boiling. You cook the jars and then you take them out. So it's probably very close to a wash time-wise once you're actually doing the cooking. But everything else is exactly the same. You know, it's you're prepping the food, putting it in the jars, and then setting them to cook in your canning pot. So I don't think it's daunting at all. The thing that I think people are afraid of, and rightly so, is that pressure canners have had a history of exploding.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to make one explode, but it's theoretically possible. I mean, they, you know, over the years, the manufacturers have improved their methods of, or their safety devices, as it were. So it's hard. It's hard to defeat the safety devices. But someone told me a story of their mom, who's a very experienced canner, works in a summer kitchen. Mm-hmm. So a kitchen detached from the house that's fairly open, has a lot of, and it was a very cool night that she was doing the pressure canning. And I guess she just cooled the canner down quickly and popped the lid, and the inrush of cold air made the jars explode.
Yeah.
And this poor woman was, I think she said she spent 2 weeks in the hospital. So, you know, you have to think and follow the procedures. But if you do, it's really, really hard to make a pressure canner.
Well, redirections, yeah.
Exactly.
I have a pressure cooker. You know, I make beans in it or cook brisket and stuff like that. And it has 3 fail safes, basically pressure relief valves built into it. It's an Italian model. It's called a Magafisa, which was highly rated by the Cook's Illustrated guys. So, yeah, I don't, you know, if you just got to be smart about it. It's like using a chainsaw. You just got to be smart about it.
Yeah, if you put the chainsaw against your skin and start it up, that's not a good idea. The pressure canner, man, when that thing's at pressure, it's hot.
Yeah.
And, you know, even just brushing against it, you could get a second degree burn. So, you know, little things that you just can't do wrong. And when you do, they hurt.
There you go. Let's go to the polar opposite. Let's talk a little bit about freezing. I like to freeze blueberries because it's dead simple, you know?
Absolutely.
I take blueberries, I rinse them, I put them on a cookie sheet, I put them in the freezer and I let them freeze, and then I throw them into one of those zipper kind of bags and I'm done.
Good for you. I absolutely endorse that approach.
If I wanted to take it one step farther, if I wanted to go a little bit more involved with freezing, where would I go?
I think you pretty much just summed it up right there. The different foods you freeze demand slightly different treatment. I teach in the book how to freeze stuff in syrup or with just added sugar or loose without any sugar or anything else. And I don't try to explain advantages to one approach over the other.
Uh-huh.
I've seen discussions that claim that if you freeze fruit in syrup, that the fruit doesn't get quite as mushy. So it's kind of better for fruit salads and stuff
and
like
syrup,
that.
And syrup, we're talking about a sugar syrup solution.
Yeah, usually anywhere from 10 to even, I think they might go as high as 50%. I can't remember exactly, but, you know, so you've got a lot of sugar in there.
Yeah.
You know, the downside then is that you got to remember to take that out of the freezer and let it melt before you can use it. Whereas individually frozen berries, the way you do it, for blueberries anyhow, are so convenient. You just grab a handful out of the bag, use them, seal the bag up, and put it back in the freezer. So for vegetables, you know, you need to blanch them in right. most cases.
Which is putting them in some boiling water on the stove for a short amount of time.
And then throwing them into cold water to stop the cooking process.
Right.
The idea of blanching, the rule of thumb is that you should blanch for about half the length of time that you'd cook. But I even joke about this in the book, because some people prefer crispy vegetables and some people prefer soft vegetables.
Yeah.
So what's half the length of time that you would normally cook? Well, for some people, it might be 3 minutes, and for others, that might be 6 minutes. And the 6 minutes would be fully cooked anyway. So, but the rule of thumb is if you cook them for 6 minutes, normally you blanch them for 3 minutes. And the idea is to kill the, or to shut down the enzymes, which even in a freezer can continue working and break down the quality of the vegetables. So that's kind of important if you hope to keep them a long, long time.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people just freeze things and use them within a few months, and you're not going to notice any degradation if you didn't blanch them in the first place.
What's the best kind of container or bag to freeze vegetables in? Those zipper bags or like kind of plastic food containers or?
I'm not sure there's a best. I object to the zipper bags because people think of them as disposable, but they're, you know, they're made for it. They're convenient. So, and I certainly wouldn't deny you using them.
I wash mine.
I was going to say my mom used to have them hanging all over the kitchen after she washed them out. And after that, I really recommend shopping around if you're going to use plastic containers, because a lot of them get brittle when they're that cold. And there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing worse as a, you know, when you're preserving food, to taking your frozen container out of the freezer, peeling the lid back and having it crack. I mean, that's just so frustrating. Yeah. So I like the ones from Ball that have the screw-on lids, but I got to say the container itself gets really brittle in the freezer.
And I've also had some freezer burn with especially just the blueberries that I've tried to freeze. Am I doing something wrong or?
No, that's an unfortunate result of storing stuff in a container that leaves airspace. I mean, another great advantage, I mean, your absolute most effective way to preserve anything, whatever method you're using except canning, is eventually somehow to get the stuff in a vacuum sealed container. So, you know, those blueberries that you freeze, if you throw them in after they're frozen, take them off your cookie sheet, put them in a vacuum seal bag, you know, suck the air out of it and put that in the freezer. I would guess those are going to be good 2 or 3 years down the road. You won't notice that they're really old.
All right, we'll be back in a minute. If you want to leave us a comment or a question or just kind of talk to us, you can leave us a message at our Garden Fork Radio voicemail, 860-740-6938. That's 860-740-6938.
When you dry things, and I wish I'd spent more time on this in the book, but when you dry things, if you put them in vacuum sealed containers, they're good 20 years down the road. You know, they'll keep that long. So again, there's no one right answer. Everyone's situation is different, but yeah, when you put stuff in a plastic container in your freezer, there's going to be airspace, and that's where you're going to see the most likely freezer burn.
All right. I'm curious about drying because I've kind of tried it in maybe a half-hearted way, but I pull up some basil plants and I hang them upside down in my greenhouse and they dry. And the dried herbs in the store always seem to taste better than the dried herbs that I've dried on my own. Are they like enhancing them somehow or vacuum sealing them or what am I doing wrong?
I'm a little suspicious of drying them in your greenhouse.
Yeah.
Because usually a greenhouse is a fairly humid environment.
Oh, and, there you go.
And the longer they hang anywhere, the longer they have to lose flavor and even pick up off flavors from mildew and stuff like that. I've tried drying in my basement just by hanging.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had some dill plants, and they developed an incredibly unpleasant odor after a few days. And I realized they weren't really drying. They were kind of rotting on the string. So I don't like the approach unless you have a really arid environment. Like people in the desert, man, they can air dry anything and they're happy. But in New England, especially, man, we're it's humid all year.
Yeah.
Well, not so much. If you're drying in the winter, you might be okay. So
then how would I do it? Because I am in New England.
Right. I encourage people if they're serious about preserving food, I really encourage you to look at dedicated food dryers, dehydrators.
There you go.
Buying one new, you know, people are hesitant because they can be pretty expensive, but I know so many people who say, oh, I found a whole dehydrator at a yard sale for $10.
That's exactly what happened to me. I got it for $5.
Okay. I mean, awesome. it can actually take a surprisingly long time for things like basil, you know, herbs that the little thin leaves, you figure, oh, those will be done quickly. I've seen it take 24 hours in a dedicated dehydrator to get those things dry. And you need to dry them at a pretty low setting if you've got a temperature control, maybe down to 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Compared to like drying fruits and vegetables. But man, when they come out, then the stems will snap like dried twigs and the leaves will just crumble. And you keep the flavor in very effectively because they've dried so quickly.
Nice. Mine is just a very, it's got the kind of slatted circular trays, and it's just an on-off switch with a heated fan that blows the air through. And I've also seen these that look like a metal square box with racks that slide in. Is there a better way? Is there a good product versus a bad product here, or is it kind of you get what you pay for? Or
I gotta say, I used to be neutral about it. You know, whatever floats your boat. And I was having a conversation with someone who asked pretty much the same question. And when I said I had no preference, they said, well, here, maybe I can give you a preference. And I really liked their thinking. With the round stackable tray dehydrators that have a fan on top, the airflow is down and up. So when you have lightweight items like herbs, they tend to just get pressed down or blown up against the trays, mm-hmm. and they stay more or less in position. But the cabinet style dehydrators blow air from the back to the front. So your lightweight items, as they dry, tend to blow to the front of the dehydrator and kind of get stacked up there.
Oh, they kind of roll across the tray they're on toward the other side of the dehydrator.
And I can see that causing irregularities in the drying, so that you might have stuff that's drier than other stuff, or you might end up with mixing that you didn't intend. So that's a little compelling to me because I dry a lot of herbs. So I like that I lucked into the round style, a Nesco American Harvest type dehydrator that has stackable trays, and the airflow goes down the sides of the trays and then back up through the middle, or vice versa. I'm not sure which, but anyhow, everything stays in place, though the really small pieces might fall through the trays to the bottom of the dehydrator. So
there was a chapter in here on fermentation in your book, and that really intrigued me because I was talking with my friend Chef Erica Wides about fermentation, and I'd like to try fermenting cabbage and things like that, but is the only thing I can make from cabbage either kimchi or sauerkraut, or is there something else that I can make when I ferment cabbage and things like that?
Well, I guess if you're talking about cabbage, technically kimchi uses the Chinese cabbages, and sauerkraut uses, you know, our traditional
the round kind,
tight-headed, round-headed cabbages and so on. But I would almost argue as soon as you're adding anything, any kind of seasoning, you're making kimchi.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, because anyone, if you walked through Korea talking to kimchi makers, and I think from my understanding, everyone in Korea makes their own, you're probably going to find that a unique recipe at each household.
Yeah.
So, you know, my kimchi happens to be cabbage with a little garlic in it. But the next door neighbors has cabbage and fruit and different vegetables and so on, and it's still kimchi. That they would still call it kimchi. So now if you just ferment cabbage, suddenly you're doing the German sauerkraut.
Could you walk us through that? Could you tell me how to do it, and maybe I'll make a video about it?
Sure. It's actually, I could even send you a link at some point if you like. My brother wrote a blog post for me once about making.
Yeah, I could put a link on the site to it.
Yeah, and it's actually a very popular post. But you want me to explain, just kind of tell you the steps now?
Yeah, like, you know, in three easy steps.
Well, it might not be three, but but it is actually really simple for any fermentation, any vegetable. It's a very basic procedure. You prepare the vegetable with cabbage. You would cut it into wedges and then cut across the grain so you get nice little strips. And then you need a fermentation container, and I recommend just finding something made of glass, and pack the cabbage in. And it's kind of an arbitrary amount of cabbage. Pack it in, actually smush it, break it, and even damage it so that it might release liquid. And then sprinkle salt on it. It's kind of a, I'm trying to remember if there was a rule of thumb, how much salt per pound of cabbage. It's best to use canning salt, which mm-hmm. has no additives to it. It doesn't have iodine or anti-clumping agents or anything like that. But offhand,
is that also called pickling salt?
A pickling salt. Yeah, sorry, I called it canning salt. Some people use sea salt, and sea salt has bigger crystals, so you might actually need to use a little bit more of it.
Right.
To get an equivalent amount. I think it's 2 teaspoons of salt, of pickling salt, for every pound of cabbage or other vegetable, whatever you're using, when you're doing this initial mixing. Mm-hmm. And you want to toss that all through, as I said, really kind of pound this stuff down, and then weigh it down. And usually you wash a dinner plate and put that on top, directly on the vegetables. And people will... There's so many ways. I think in the book I show using a quart canning jar full of water as a weight to push that down. But I've also seen people fill a plastic bag with water and then put that inside, and it'll press up against the sides of the fermentation container as well as down on the plate and help seal off air, which
there you go.
Seems like a pretty nice idea. You let it sit for a day. And if it develops enough liquid on its own to cover the vegetables or cabbage, you're golden. And if it doesn't, then you should cook up a little bit of water and salt so that you can top it up and get it under the water. And the ratio for that might be about 1.5 tablespoons of salt per quart of water. Mm-hmm. And it's a good idea to heat that just to kill anything that's living in it. Not that it's going to matter with the salt, but let it cool. And add that so that all the vegetables are underwater. And that's crucial. They have to be underwater. Any piece that sticks up out of the water is where microbes are going to land on it and try to reproduce and grow little colonies and stuff. And that's why you weight it down as well. And then finally, what I recommend in the book, I learned from my brother, who's a beer brewer, get a plastic bag of some sort and put a rubber band around the lip of the jar to hold the bag all the way around so that it's kind of an impermeable layer. Mm-hmm. As the fermentation starts, the carbon dioxide will come up out of the brine, fill the chamber, pushing air out, and it'll come out around the rubber band because there's enough flexibility there.
Yep.
And pretty soon you'll have an air-free environment. It'll just be carbon dioxide where all the unfavorable microbes should not be able to grow.
So you have an oxygen-free environment. It's all carbon dioxide. Wow, sweet.
That's the goal. Now, that doesn't give you license to ignore it.
Yeah.
You know, if you ignore it, you're going to look in a week and there's going to be mold growing on it. You should really check it every day. And if you see scum growing on the plate or on the surface or anything, take off the cover and scrape that out of there right away and get rid of it. If you stay ahead of the scum you're likely to see some growing, but if you stay ahead of it, the kraut or whatever else you're fermenting is going to develop a real nice flavor. If you let that stuff sit on there for even a few days, the flavor is going to kind of permeate through the liquid, and yeah, it'll be in the vegetables. And even if they'll be safe to eat, but they're probably going to taste kind of moldy or off or whatever. So
Is there a particular length of time we should do this, or is it kind of a personal choice?
I go with personal choice. To me, this it should always be about experimentation until you're doing something that could kill you, and then probably shouldn't go there. But so with fermentation, you know, some people are going to like it 2 days after they set it out to ferment, and some people are going to like it 6 months later. The trick is, or one of the tricks is that the temperature that it's fermenting in can have a huge effect on how quickly it ferments.
Yeah.
And I've actually heard people reporting when they've made pickles, fermented cucumbers this year, that their cucumbers have gone all the way in just a week, which is really fast.
That is.
If you know, in a 60 degree room, I would expect pickles or, you know, cucumbers to ferment into pickles in 4 to 6 weeks. And most, I would also anticipate for a mature sauerkraut that you might wait 4 weeks. But I've had stuff go crazy this year. I've had, I also tried to ferment pickles, and they were done in, well, pretty much like what everyone else has said, in about a week. So,
is there an ideal temperature that we should have our kraut jar?
Well, I would encourage you, if there's any way you can ferment it 50 to 60 degrees, that's what I'd recommend. Maybe up to 70, but by the time you're up to 70, it's going to move pretty fast.
Yeah.
You can also control the rate of fermentation by adding more salt.
Oh, neat.
But understand, you're going to have more salt in it.
Yeah, it's going to taste saltier.
And I've actually read some exchanges from people saying, man, my pickles are done, but they're so salty. What can I do about it? And you know, my best answer is use less salt next time.
But, note to self.
But you can actually leach the salt out by soaking the vegetables in fresh water.
There you go.
The downside of that is you're also going to be leaching out some of the acid and flavor that they developed in the ferment. And
they did.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot of work. So I tend toward the side of using too little salt.
Because you can always add more. It's just like when you're finishing a dish. You know?
Well, if you need it for flavor, but you know, the trick is to balance it against room temperature. And so I think what I concluded this summer is I'm not going to do my ferments until it gets cold, or, you know, mid to late autumn.
To where your basement's cool enough that you could do it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, why? I don't want to pump more energy in by air conditioning or something like that. So I'm just going to wait till the weather cooperates and it's a little cooler. So
what vegetables have you run across that you can ferment that maybe people listening wouldn't have thought of before?
You can ferment anything. I mean, you know, vodka is fermented potatoes. So
all right, we'll have to do that.
I have a jar of chickpeas that I fermented or put in the fermentation tank about 3 months ago, and they look for about 3 weeks, they smelled incredible. I mean, it was such a delicious, earthy, organic flavor or odor that they were giving off. And they've stabilized now, and they're just sitting there. I don't think there's much more going on. And I expect when I have some time some year, I'll grind them up and make a loaf out of them. And I expect it to have some really interesting character. So I'm not sure what to tell you. I mean, if you go with it's a vegetable that you can eat, mm-hmm, you can ferment it.
Wow.
Give it a shot. See what you like, you know? I know someone inspired by my book tried fermenting chard and reported that it was really salty and that she didn't like it at all. And she was going to try again, but she hasn't gotten around to it yet. And I'm a little worried that maybe she was so put off by it that she doesn't want to try it again.
Yeah.
Which is a shame, because I think if you like sauerkraut at all, you're going to find a lot of other vegetables make really delicious ferments as well. So,
well, I think I'm sure that some of the listeners that are listening to this now, and I know a couple by name, are going to kind of take this and run with it. So We'll have some feedback.
One tip I'd suggest is, you know, prepare the vegetables to resemble the thickness of your cabbage. So, you know, shave the carrots or shave the potatoes or whatever. Make them thin. They'll ferment through more quickly. So if you want to try them in 4 days, they're probably going to be ready, or at least ready enough. But you know, a lot of people express fear. Oh, you know, you're actually rotting stuff and then going to eat it. And that's kind of what you're doing. But.
Well, so is dry aged beef. So.
Oh, sure. I mean, I think in fact, in central Pennsylvania, there's a tradition of fermenting salami. Is it salami? Or some kind of sausage. They call them blinnies or something like that, or blennies. And they fill a sausage casing and they ferment the things with meat. So it's, you know, it's safe because it's in an environment where germs that can hurt you can't grow. And even if the mold and bacteria develop on top, if you remove it quickly, it won't cause a bad flavor. But also, once it sinks, if any of it sinks into the brine, it's going to die. So it's not going to be bad for it. So, and the final incentive for people to try it, you know, the probiotics movement is kind of big right now. It's a big word in nutrition.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Well,
I think I have it in my yogurt now.
Exactly. Well, this stuff is full of probiotic stuff. So if you don't cook it before you eat it, you're going to get a boatload of it.
I listen to the radio traffic station when I'm driving around to make sure I don't get stuck, because I'm already stuck usually. But there's an advertisement for a brand of horseradish, and the advertisement claims by eating a teaspoon of horseradish a day, you introduce these amazing probiotics into your body. Is horseradish is a fermented horseradish root, correct?
I guess I hadn't thought of that, but yeah. Yeah, that's a ferment. I mean, you know, probably a lot of stuff you consume you don't even think of as fermentation. Like swinging a little bit in another direction, but related, is the whole quick pickling thing.
Yeah.
Which, you know, people, for the most part today, I think of pickling as taking vegetables and adding vinegar and salt and maybe some sugar.
And putting them in a canning jar.
And putting it in a canning jar. Well, that's... First of all, the vinegar is fermented juice of some sort, probably apple juice or whatever. So there was fermentation that went into making the vinegar. Well, traditional fermented vegetables were the original way to make pickles. That, you know, you didn't pre-ferment a liquid and put this stuff in. You just let them develop their own acid. And I've repeated this to many people because it is probably one of the greatest moments I've had with any of the projects in the book. Was the first time I fermented cucumbers and fished one out of the fermentation tank, kind of looking at it like, yeah, okay. But first of all, just opening the tank, it had a perfect pickle smell to it. I mean, it was just like, wow, this is exactly what pickles are supposed to smell like. And I bit into it and it was absolutely the perfect pickle flavor. And I was just like, wow. You know, this is awesome.
That's great.
It was kind of mind-boggling. And you can probably still find places where you could buy a fermented pickle out of a wooden cask, you know, I mean, or a wooden barrel, rather. That's how people used to store their food.
Yeah, there's some delis in the city. When I'm in the city, they still have them. I'm not... The only kind of pickles I like are bread and butter pickles, because I just like sugar. So.
Okay, yeah, well, those are real nice, too. So.
Is and there... We're running out of time, but we didn't really touch on pickling except for kind of the fermentation side. But for people that are making traditional pickles from cucumbers and canning them in a jar and that kind of thing, is there a common mistake or a little tip you can give us?
Well, I guess I'd go more with expressing concern. That I see a lot of people talking about their canning projects online who say, oh, I do this, then I put them in a boiling water bath for 15 minutes. And I'm not always seeing an acid ratio or a specific amount of acid that, that sounds right or that sounds comforting. And so I encourage anyone, make sure that you're using recipes that are really closely similar to what the USDA says they've tested. And the USDA even will tell you this, you can add acid safely, but if you reduce the acid content and do a typical quick pickling, you could end up with dangerous food.
And an acid, we're talking about like a vinegar.
Vinegar. And they always start with find a vinegar that says 5% acid. Until someone tells you this, you probably haven't noticed that the vinegar bottle tells you how much acid it is, and it's usually 5%. So start with that. And if you don't know, then shop for different vinegar. And then usually you're cutting it with quite a bit of water and adding the salt. And I'm very confident from everything I've read that the salt isn't really doing much to preserve things for you here. It's really the acid, the vinegar. So backing the salt off a little bit is probably okay. But backing off the vinegar would be dangerous.
A red flag.
Yeah. So, you know, and the USDA tells you, never deviate from our recipes, which, you know, is maybe extreme, but I don't want to be the person who told you it's okay and then you get sick. So, you know, look at what the USDA says. If you want to change a recipe, add a little vinegar. Make sure that, and if you want to know how to can or preserve broccoli or cauliflower or something like that, find the recipe where someone's doing that and use those ratios. A great rule of thumb is if you're mixing different vegetables in a pickle jar, always make sure you're using the amount of acid or the ratio of acid that's appropriate for the one that the USDA says takes the highest amount of acid. You know, for a cucumber, it might be, you know, 25%, and don't quote me on this, but you know, I'm just making up a number here, but it might be 20% acid, or sorry, 20% vinegar for a cucumber, but then maybe for broccoli, it might be 35%. So if you're mixing the two in a jar, make sure you go to the 35%.
And you can find us everywhere by going, you just type in USDA.gov, USDA.gov, and in the search bar there, just type in pickling or
they
brine.
They have awesome websites, man. You can find so much really, really useful information from a different university. Each university seems to have their own version of the same information. So it's.
I love it. Cool. And oh, and by the way, everyone, we are doing a giveaway for Daniel's book. The publicist, whose name I'm blanking on, sorry, sent me two copies. Lola. And yes. I'm sorry, I owe her an email because she sent these books a while back, and then I do have a stack of them, so I go through them. but we have two copies of this book, and it's called Yes, You Can, and Freeze and Dry It Too, The Modern Step-by-Step Guide to Preserving Food. I really like this one. It's, I don't know, I could gush about it some more, but a lot of good pictures. Did you take the pictures, Daniel?
Most of the photos I took, yes. All the how-to ones were from me, and some of the, you know, decorative ones too. So
that's great. There's some nice pictures of the dehydration here, which I like. So those dried tomatoes look really good. Those dried tomatoes look delicious.
If you do them, I don't know if I encourage people to make them with olive oil in there. I think I did. If you use the olive oil and then you dry them, oh, they're such an amazing snack.
Yeah, it says right here, olive oil. Cool.
Okay, yeah. That's not useful if you're going to preserve them a long time. But if you just want a great snack, a little olive, it gets on your fingers. The flavor is sensational.
We use our food dehydrator, and like we'll dehydrate a bunch of apples, and they don't usually last a week.
Exactly.
Because we just start eating them. And I'm thinking, we're going to save this for winter, and then they're gone.
I mean, my kids will never ask for dried bananas. But if I throw 6 pounds of bananas in the dehydrator and set them out the next day, they're gone. So it's just, I don't know. What I love about preserving is you often create new foods when you preserve.
Yeah, I'm kind of excited. I want to go make sauerkraut now. So,
well, you know, good luck with it. I find I'm not a big fan of sauerkraut, so that doesn't compel me nearly as much as something like a kimchi or, like I said, these chickpeas that I fermented. I'm really quite excited about. So,
is there somewhere where we can learn more about you if we want to?
Wow. I have a website where I talk about all this stuff and growing the food too, which is smallkitchengarden.net.
Cool.
And I'd love to have people come. I also have recently started a group, an open group on Facebook about home fruit and vegetable preserving.
Okay. Where's that?
Well, I think it's actually called Home Fruit and Vegetable Preservers.
I'll link to all this in the show notes, everybody.
Of course, I just hit the wrong button on my computer. I'd be there now and could tell you exactly what it's called, but.
It's an open group, meaning that they don't have to be approved to join or anything.
I think you still have to, if you haven't been invited, what open means is that someone who's already in can just join someone else,
right,
just by saying they're in.
But so people could contact you and go
right,
in.
If people come to the group and they just post a request, and I so far have always let, you know, just put everyone in who's asked. I suppose if someone shows up and starts trying to sell stuff or something, I might.
Right.
yes, it's called Home Fruit and Vegetable Preservers.
Cool.
And it's a small group so far, 70 or so people. But some of them are very lively. I mean, one woman there has, you know, she calls it her garden. Clearly, it's a farm intended to serve a small community. And I think she wakes up in the morning and starts preserving stuff. And then goes to bed when she's, you know, I mean, I don't see how she has time to be on Facebook, but she posts a lot of stuff. So
good for her. Good for you guys.
She's pretty impressive.
All right. Well, Daniel, thanks. Everyone, we'll have a book giveaway. Come to our site and click on the link for this show. The show will probably be called How to Can, Freeze, Dry, Pickle, Ferment Your Food, something like that, in the Garden Fork Radio section. So you can find Daniel at smallkitchengarden.net or on Facebook at the Home Fruit and Vegetable Preservers. You can reach us at eric@gardenfork.tv. I'm on Twitter at gardenforktv, all one word, and facebook.com/gardenfork. So Daniel, thanks again.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Garden Fork's theme music is used under license from uniquetracks.com. Thank you.